Good morning, everyone. Is it me or am I more red than usual? It's the lighting today, isn't it? Red is the color of danger. Right, let's begin then. So with permission from the most noble Triple Gem, Venerable Nun, before we begin today's proceedings, let us bring our palms together in veneration of the great master, our teacher, our guide. He is the perfect one, the undefeated one, the unvanquished one, the timeless one. He who is the epitome of morality and the fount of wisdom. It is the path that he laid down for us today, which we traverse, confident and convinced that at the end of this path lies the oasis of Nibbana, which he once traveled to, and he beckoned us all to get there with bravery, courage, and determination. So as we bring our palms together in veneration today, let us remind ourselves that this is not just a mere veneration to his holy name, but also a pledge of allegiance that we take upon ourselves to walk this path, the noble path, and to achieve the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. And after we've done that, let us take refuge in the Noble Triple Gem, observe the precepts, and continue with today's proceedings.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Last week I was on the way back, I was thinking to myself, what great sports you are. Can you hear me clearly? So I was thinking to myself, what great sports you are, because we are in a room full of people, and there are people who are in their youth, people who are in the middle age, people who are in the later stages of their life, people who are really someone in society. People look up to you, they look up to you, they respect you. You are someone who demands respect. I mean, not demand respect in that way, but what you do, your service and all that. Despite all that, I was thinking to myself last week when we did that little activity, and I asked if all of you were willing to stand up. You know, like little children, you all were, yes, I mean, so you want us to stand up, we'll stand up. Each and every one of you, you were so willing to do that. And I don't think that as, I don't take that as a little thing. I think personally for me that's a big deal. The fact that you are happy to be molded by a teacher, the fact that you don't care what, you know, the fact that you're mature, you are an elderly person for some of you. Because usually in a gathering, people tend to make sure that they remain composed and they maintain a sense of dignity, right? But when we have a bit of an activity and it's a bit for a bit of fun, and I ask, can you all stand up? And everyone's standing up. It's not a little thing. It's not a small thing. I think the fact that you were so willing to do it without any hesitation itself is actually quite an achievement. Now you might think, Swami, so what are you talking about? That was no big deal. Well, you say that, but there are people for whom it's a big deal. Right? People will think, you know, who does he think I am to stand up at his beck and call? I'm here, sat down, I'm here to listen to the sermon. If I sit down, I'm only going to stand up at the end of the sermon. Or if I have to go to the washroom. No other time is anyone going to stand me up. But there are people like that. There are people like that. People sometimes who are a bit snobbish maybe, or people who are a bit, what's the word, big-headed. But your humility and your humbleness, I think, is one of your greatest assets. You know, regardless of what walk of life you come from, how educated you are, it all of that is evidence of the fact that you're gradually working away from your sense of identity. Because if your sense of identity, excuse me, if your sense of identity prevents you from doing something, because it hurts you, then you have a problem. Let me push it to the extreme end. One of these days, don't worry, I won't ask you to do it, but you must be prepared to. One of these days, if I ask you to come here and do a somersault, or put your hands up on your head like a rabbit, and just keep hopping on the stage, from left to right, you should be able to do that. You should be able to do that without any mental vexation, without any friction. Why do you think it's difficult for people to do that? You know, a kid, they don't have a problem with that, do they? You ask a little child to do that, you won't be able to get them to stop. But if you ask an adult to do something like that, you know, hold their hands above. You remember when you were in your primary, right? You put your hand up like that, and you just keep jumping around. If someone asked you to do that after you are once you become an adult, it doesn't seem natural, does it? Of course, we don't do that generally because it's not what society, it's not what people expect of us. Right? It would look childish. It would look odd and weird if an adult would do that. It would be like, you know, if you saw someone start walking backwards all of a sudden, that would be weird. Right? People would wonder what was going on. But if I demanded that of you, if you had to do it in the name of Nibbana, you should be able to come up here and do it while the whole world is staring at you. And on top of that, even if the whole audience were pointing their finger at you and going, ha ha, or if they were laughing at you, mocking you, you should still be able to do that. Why can't people do that? Because it's, what, embarrassing? Embarrassing. What is embarrassment? Is embarrassment something that someone can give you? Is embarrassment something that someone can make you feel? Someone can make you feel? What is embarrassment then? You make that within your own mind. That's why we always talk about this. Everything's in the mind. You cook it all up. It's all mind-made. Embarrassment is mind-made, ladies and gentlemen. That is why certain things you will do out in public, but other things you won't. But there are other things you will do behind closed doors, behind a curtain. Because there, no one's watching you. And then it's okay. I don't need to spell things out to you. You're all mature enough and old enough to understand and come up with your own examples of things like this. Things that people would do when no one's watching. And then it's not so embarrassing. See, think about it. Now, I'll take a simple example, right? This is as simple as it can get. Let's say your tummy is full of air. So it has to go one way or the other. either upwards or there's a path of least resistance. There's the other way as well. Now, let's say you were alone at home and your tummy was full of air. What might you do? You just walk up and down, right, just to get the air flowing. And then after a while, you'd pass it out. We call it passing wind. So when you hear those noises that your body makes as it passes that wind out, do you feel embarrassed? Think about it for a second. I'm trying to prove a point to you here. Would you feel embarrassed when that happens? What if the dog was around? Would you then feel embarrassed? Still no. Why do you not feel embarrassed? Because when the dog's around, someone else is around. Because here's what you know. The dog's not going to think anything bad of you. Your dog is very loyal, very trustworthy. And even if your dog thought anything bad of you, he's not going to go tell the neighbors. So think about it, right? This is a very normal bodily function. When there's wind, then there's air in your bubbles, you have to let it out. Yeah, there's only one of two ways you can do it, either up here or down there. But you don't feel embarrassed in those situations. You don't feel embarrassed, ladies and gentlemen, because it's not the passing of wind that causes embarrassment. You have to create embarrassment in your mind. You have to manufacture it. See, your minds are factories. They're emotional factories. Don't you get it? Your minds are emotional factories. They manufacture, they fabricate these emotions. Now, who here likes to feel embarrassment? No one likes to feel embarrassed. But can you stop yourself from feeling it? When it happens, right? You can't stop yourself from feeling it. You don't like it, but it happens nonetheless. Isn't that the problem? In other words, isn't that why you're here? There are things happening within you which are out of your control. And you don't like that. You want to, for want of a better word, rein yourself in. That's what you want to do. You have all these emotions that are cooking up inside you, and you don't want to experience those emotions, but you can't stop them either because you've completely lost control of those emotions. And that's why you bring yourself here. You're here to try and learn how to engineer your mind so that you can only think the thoughts that you like to think. And embarrassment is one of them. Now, to continue with my example, when you're alone at home, passing wind is not embarrassing. A few people just walked into the room, they're thinking, what the heck of a sermon this is going to be? You're talking about passing wind. Did we just walk into the right room or what's this? When the dog's there, you still don't feel embarrassed because you think the dog's not going to think anything of you. If only you could read the dog's mind. Sometimes you do things because you can't read the people's minds, minds of the people around you. So you think they won't think anything bad of you. How do you know? In the same manner that you fabricate emotions in your mind, others do as well. What guarantee do you have that the dog doesn't mock you in its mind? It's probably thinking, wait till I meet the rest of my pack this evening. I'm going to tell them all about my master. You know, maybe when the dogs meet each other in the evening, right, they compare how loudly their masters. Maybe that's something they boast about. Who knows? But all kidding aside, the point I'm trying to drill down here is these are emotions you cook inside yourself, ladies and gentlemen. Now, you see, the same situation, let's say someone walked into the room. As you were passing wind, someone just walked into the room. So as you, let's say this Sorry, you're okay for me to continue with this example, right? Just check. Or am I embarrassing you? We are very down-to-earth people. So, you know, I don't put myself up on a pedestal of some sort. I'm a very down-to-earth man. You know, if these are things that happen with our bodies, what's the problem? I'm not speaking profanity. These are just very, very normal things, and they happen with our bodies, right? So I should be able to take on another day passing stools or passing urine or vomiting, things like that. Although society sometimes might consider these things as very repulsive, you know, if you were a medical student, would it be repulsive? No. I'm not talking about things that happen to aliens. I'm talking about things that happen with your bodies. You experience this day and day out. So, okay for me to continue with this example? Or would you like me to choose something more? I don't know. Okay, I'm getting more nods than blank faces, so I'll take that as a green light for me to continue. So let's say you this passing wind, right? It takes you the best part of 5 seconds. And let's say it takes you the best part of 5 seconds. So you get started. Now the clock starts ticking. 1, 2. You're still alone in the room, right? No problem. On the third second, someone walks in. Someone walks into the room. Do you begin to feel embarrassed? Wait. It depends, doesn't it? It depends on a bunch of different things. Sometimes there are cultural norms. Now, would you believe me that in some countries, after you've had a good meal, the best way to thank your hosts for a nice meal is to pass wind, not that way, but the other way. So much so that if you didn't burp in their presence, they'd feel offended. Because that's the way you say, that was one heck of a meal. Thank you. One burp is enough. It speaks volumes. So it's a cultural thing. So it all depends on that. Cultural norms. Also, it depends on your relationship with that person. See, what if it was your girlfriend? You only exchanged your feelings for her last week. So she's your brand new girlfriend. She walks into the room. At the third second, what are you going to do? Wish you were never born. But the same individual, fast forward 5 years, 6 years, 10 years. I know what you're talking about. Now what is she? Come on. Now she's your wife. Is there anything you have to hide from her? Nothing to hide now. So if she walks in, you'd say, good timing, darling. I was just expressing my love in a different way. So how come 6 years ago, what you would have never dreamt of doing, not in your wildest imagination, 6 years later, it just seems like the normal thing to do? And God knows, you know, she might reciprocate the gesture. She might say, two's better than one. I'll stop there. Once again, let's bring the conversation back to the point I'm trying to make here. It's good to have a laugh. Sunday mornings, that's what we should do. Stretch our muscles a little bit. relax ourselves, because it's been a long week, hasn't it, for most of you? Unlike my week. I've been doing this every day of the week. But for the rest of you, this is the only day of the week you get to actually laugh and smile and just be happy for once. So let's do that as well. But let's come back to the point I was trying to make. So how come your embarrassment is determined by environmental factors? You know, if it's passing wind that is what is embarrassing, then you must feel that even when you're alone. Excuse me. If it's the presence of someone else that can perceive what's going on, then you must feel embarrassed even when your dogs are out. If it's the presence of someone you know, then you must feel the same even when your wife or your husband's around. But not so. Meaning, a whole host of these causes has an effect on you internally. And you decide when you create embarrassment for yourself and when you don't. That's the point I want to make. So you can never say, don't embarrass me to someone else, because no one else embarrasses you. You cook it up inside of you. Now let's imagine you were blindfolded. Right, let's say you were blindfolded and we use some, earplugs. Right? So your ears are blocked, your eyes are blindfolded. You were walked into this room and you were the first person into this room, and now you think you are alone. So just before you were blindfolded, you looked around the room and there was no one here, and you think you are alone. But now your ears are plugged, your eyes are blindfolded, and the rest of us walk into the room. You still think you are alone. Okay? And there's wind again in your tummy. You still think you are alone. What might you do? There you go. And that's because you don't know that there are others in the room. I'll give you another example. Something maybe more familiar. Like when you go to a washroom, particularly if you go to a public washroom, chances are before you start using the washroom, you open the tap. Right? Because then the bucket starts filling with water, and that noise muffles any other noise that you might end up making. Yes or no? All toilet examples today. What an audience you must be. Again, I'm talking specifically about embarrassment today. Not embarrassment. Because we've talked about anger, we've talked about greed, we've talked about sensuality. These are all creations of the mind, and so is embarrassment. But ask yourself why you do that. Now, courtesy is one reason, I get that. Politeness is one reason, I get that. I get all that. That should all be because you care about the people around you. But embarrassment occurs not because you care about people around you. Embarrassment occurs only when you sense a self. This is one of the ways in which you preserve yourself. This is your internal self-preservation mechanism. Embarrassment. Your mind starts to vex. The mind starts to think, what might others think of me? What might others think of me? People look up to me, they respect me, and if they hear me making all these noises, what might people think of me? So you try to muffle those noises. I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't, okay? Please. Do as you normally do, but I'm trying to drive home a different point altogether. That is the fact that embarrassment is something you create, you manufacture in your own mind, in your emotional factory. There are some people in front of whom you would not take off any item of clothing that you are clad in right now. Pretty much most people. But then change circumstances, change the situation, and you're okay. But perhaps the same person, maybe a few years ago, it would be the same thing again. Strangers. See, your relationship with them, remember we talked once about relationships? And whether it is something you have with the other person or something you have actually within yourself? Please bear in mind that you don't know about your wife's presence. She might be stood right next to you, ladies and gentlemen, but you don't know about that. Your wife is something you cook up in your own mind. Outside, there's matter and there's a mind. But the fact that she's your wife or your husband, where does that occur? That occurs in your mind. Remember last week or the week before, I said, if you were sat at the dinner table, on the left-hand side you have your husband, on the right-hand side you have your son or your child, and they're holding on to your hand, do they feel a wife's love or a mother's love? Is it something you emanate through your hands, through your body? No. If that were so, when you cross your hands or your arms, they should start feeling the opposite emotion, shouldn't they? And that doesn't happen. Meaning, the other party cooks up, fabricates an identity for you in their own minds. Don't you agree with me? So they fabricate that identity for you in your own minds. In just the same way, you fabricate identities for the people around you and yourself. When you're holding on to your mother's hand, what sort of identity do you feel? The boys in the room? That of a son. The girls in the room? That of a daughter. But when you hold on to your husband's hand or your wife's hand, now what sort of identity do you create within yourself? Who are you at that point? You're the husband or the wife, or you're the spouse. So, what changed? What changed your identity? Was it the external environment or your interpretation of the external environment? When you think that the person that's outside, the person that you're looking at, is so and so, you become the counterpart. This is all happening in the mind. I really need you to get this on board, because some of the upcoming things that I'm going to talk about is all going to be based on this foundation. So unless you are fully aware, conscious, and have understood that everything that's going on with you are all creations in your own mind, the rest of what we have to talk about will not make a lot of sense. That's why I'm going over and over the same point here. I want to make sure that you all understand that. You have to have come to a point, ladies and gentlemen, in your lives where over the last week, let's say, that when you're not here, you are beginning to re-evaluate your emotions. Emotions like embarrassment, emotions like fear, emotions like lust, emotions like greed, emotions like jealousy, and a whole host of other emotions. Whenever you feel these emotions, you must have come to a point now in your life where you know that you are wholly responsible for those emotions, because no third party actually gets involved in any of that. It's all you're doing. I need you to have come to that position now. Because from that is where we are going to build up the next part of this conversation. In other words, you're an island. Nothing's come in, nothing's gone out. Your emotions are all your own fabrications. So, are you scared of spiders? Are you scared of actual spiders? Is it the spider that scares you? Can a spider scare you? How about ghosts? What if they're really spooky? Can a ghost scare you? What about Mahasona? What if you see Mohini? As you pass Borella, you see on the cemetery. You're driving around at night. You stop because you've got a flat tire, you get out, and there's a woman holding a child. She says, can you hold the baby for me while I do my dress? The old joke goes, what? You hold the child, I'll do the dress. It's an old joke from our boys' schools. But, you know, people are scared of these things. People are scared of ghosts because they think it's the ghost that scares them. In just the same way that you feel that it's someone else that angers you. See, until you live like that, ladies and gentlemen, you will always feel that you are a victim of circumstances. What a pity. Don't ever let circumstances victimize you. Actually, circumstances never victimize you. You think they do. Any pain that is real must only be a physical pain. Every other pain is a mental fabrication. Every other one is a mental fabrication. Categorically, comprehensively. Take my word for it if you don't believe me just yet. But that's what you need to understand. That's what you need to comprehend. Every mental pain, agony that you go through is all your doing. No one else is responsible for that. Are you willing to accept responsibility for that? Are you willing to accept responsibility for that? For all your mental suffering? It's about time that you took accept responsibility for that. That is what maturing is. To mature in the Dhamma is to accept responsibility for all suffering. And to stop pointing your finger outwards. And to stop looking for the culprit on the outside. The culprits are all within you. The Buddha's job was to help you identify them. That's why he said, Tanhaya Jayati Soko. And Tanhaya Jayati Bhayan. Tanha is attachment. Where there is attachment, there is always going to be fear and there is always going to be sorrow. Fear and sorrow, these two things encapsulate all other mental, and they represent all other mental suffering that you go through. My attachment can never make you suffer. Why is that? Can I transfer attachment to you? In the same way that I can throw this at you, do you think I can throw a bit of attachment at you? If you could, I mean, if that were possible, just throw all your attachment at me and walk away, a free man. I'll catch it all. I'll deal with it. If you stood up and walked to the other side of the room, what's happened to the attachment that was in you? It's moved with you, right? So then what does that say about attachment? Where does it live? It lives within you. So attachment is never something that anyone else can transfer across to you. So you might ask me this question, what Swamina answered though about when someone walks up to me and you will quote one of my own sermons from the past and he'll say, Swamina, what about if someone walks up to me and says they love me? And then I start to have feelings towards them. Was it not them who were responsible for me feeling that attachment? If that were so, I dare you to try that with me. Their words alone cannot trigger attachment within your hearts, ladies and gentlemen. You need to have ignorance within you first. Ignorance is the root of attachment. It is only if you have ignorance within you can attachment begin to grow. If ignorance is the root, attachment is the stem that grows from it. So for as long as you have ignorance, then what people say to you, what people do to you, the things you see, the things you hear, the things you experience will have an impact on you. And ignorance is really not knowing how to react and respond to them in the right way. That's what ignorance is after all. So, let's wrap all that up again before we continue to the next stage of our discussion. The salient point in all this is this. all of these emotions are cooked up where? In your own mind. Are you in any denial about any of that? You must accept that to proceed from here on. You must accept that. All of your emotions are all made within you. These are not things that other people can transfer across to you. Respect is not something that someone can show you. The actions, there are certain actions, there are certain behaviors we put into the respect category. But I could always pretend to respect you, but in my mind, I could be cursing you. Can't people do lip service? Sometimes you might be the subject of that a lot of time in society. People just give you lip service. They lick your boots, kiss your, you know what? Sometimes they do it only because they want to be in your good books. They want to be on your Christmas list or your Christmas card list. Like we talked about last week, there are always strings attached. But here's what they know. They know that because you're ignorant, when they demonstrate certain behaviors, you will mistake them. You will mistake them and think that they are respecting you. That it is respect they're showing you. Respect is not something that someone can show you. You know, if you ever feel that someone disrespects you, okay, this is something to bear in mind. This is good advice to bear in mind. Because there will be times where you feel that way and you will feel hurt. In those moments, try and remember these words. When you feel hurt because someone has disrespected you, and that disrespect you might feel come from your children, very common. Sometimes you might feel it comes from your husband. Sometimes you feel it might come from your wife. It might come from your colleagues, come from your subordinates, your neighbors, strangers even, your driver if you have one, or your maid if you have one. In such instances where you feel disrespected, try and remember these words. And here are those words. Disrespect is what you feel towards yourself in those moments. So who's disrespecting whom? You create disrespect, that emotion of disrespect you create in your own minds, and then because you have created in your own mind, now you can't stop yourself from feeling that. And then what do? You do what you should never be doing, that is to project it onto the person standing in front of you. And then you think to yourself, this guy, he's just disrespected me. I must teach him a lesson. And you know what you do after that? You disrespect them. So if disrespect is like that, what about respect? So shall I ask you a question? Have you ever respected me? Well, Swami Noah says here, he comes here every week to talk to you. Have you ever respected me? What about when you get down on your knees and you worship? With such devotion and piety, you get down on all fours and you worship Swami Nuhanse. Is that you respecting me? I'll tell you what's going on at that time. In your mind, you create the emotion of respect. The sentiment of respect is created in your mind. It does you a great deal of good. It does you tremendous amounts of good. Because what the mind thinks, it really does for itself, not to me. So why do I stand there while you worship? And sometimes, you know, if you get down on your knees, I might stand there and say, Supadeva, I give you my blessings. And I remain there. Well, at the end of the sermon, you come here, right? Usually at the end of the sermon, that's another sermon, right? another 20 to 30 minute sermon here at the end of every sermon. So, because you come up here, you talk about how grateful you are, how happy you are, how much you have transformed as a person, and how everyone else has begun to feel you as a blessing in their lives and all that. And great, it's great to hear all that. So when you come up here and you say all that and then you show your respect, I don't for a moment think that it is me that you are respecting, because respect is not something you can transfer to me. That's why I say, I come here expecting nothing from you, because there is nothing you can give me. Even if you wanted to. Then you must wonder, why is it that I still come? If it's not even respect can you give me, why is it I still come? Here's why. Because when you get on your knees and you worship, you create respect in your own mind. And that does you a great deal of good. Because that's one of the 10 meritorious deeds. That's one of the meritorious deeds. To show respect, regard, and piety towards that which deserves it. Remember, that which deserves it is also created in your own mind. Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, they exist. So when you think that you're respecting Swami Nuhanse, actually it's not Swami Nuhanse that you respect. Let's think about this for a second. If you met me in my lay life, or if you saw me walking into this room, clad like you are, without my robe, let's be frank, would you show me the same level of respect as you do today, seeing me in a robe? No. So then you come here, you sit down, you listen to the sermons. And you listen to the sermons, and you listen to the sermons, you begin to understand the sermons, right? And then you see the Swami Nuhanse carries his alms bowl, he goes an alms round, right? He gives us an opportunity to engage in merits. These are all deeds which you rejoice in. It's the deed that you rejoice in. Really, it's not Swami Nuhanse that you like. It's what he does that you like. If I did completely the opposite of all the things that I do right now, say instead of talking to you about loving kindness and compassion and metta and the Dhamma, I come up here and I start talking about violence and spreading hatred. And I said, you know, pick up your weapons, let's go fight and kill them and torture them and murder them. Let no one speak against you. Fight, retaliate. If I spoke like that, would you come and show me respect? Then please answer this question. Is it me that you respect, or the message that I bring that you respect? It's the message. So then it is not right for me to take those prayers, those blessings, those worships, those mark of respect as something that is due to me, because it's not due to me. It is something that you offer, not to this individual. It's something that you offer to the good deed, to the meritorious deed, to the virtuous deed. It's to virtuousness you make your offering. And I understand that, I know that. And rightly so. Rightly so. So why again then do I allow you to come and do that? Because when you do so, respect is created in your mind. And that's a meritorious deed. As that meritorious deed occurs in your mind, you earn merits, and those merits help pave the path to your own salvation. And that's why we let you do it. Once you become an arahant, don't come ever this way, because you don't need merits anymore. Because in the sasana, ladies and gentlemen, the individual has no place. There's no place for an individual in the sasana. Because you know what? The word sasana itself means void of an individual. To void of an individual is what the word sasana means. To rid the individual. To eliminate the individual. To exterminate the individual. This is what the word sasana means. So in the sasana, how can we have respect towards individuals? So have I made myself clear then about these emotions and how they're all cooked up in the mind? So then you name it. I'll name a few. You tell me where they're created. Anger. Someone gives you, or you create inside. Hatred. Lust. Love. Pity. Sympathy. Empathy. Anger. Embarrassment. It's all in the mind. Right. Now let me take you back and try and ring an old bell. Let's see if this bell still rings in your mind. We talked some time ago that all innovations are rooted in something. What was that something? Necessity. Necessity is the mother of invention. So all inventions are rooted in necessity. I remember the old example. Why is there a pen in this room? There's a necessity. A necessity for what? To write. To write on particularly a whiteboard. That's why they have created a pen. Every object on this, every object in your sight right now are all products of necessity, right? So what about you then? What about you? You or you as a whole, what about you? If all of these things are the product of an effort, an endeavor to address a necessity, what about you as a whole? The same goes, right? What about your nose then? That's a product of necessity. And your ears? Every single part of you, every cell in your body is a product of an endeavor to fulfill a necessity. What is that necessity, do you think? What is that necessity? Now, one simple way, well, I wouldn't say it's simple, but one way to try and find an answer to this is, have a think about for whom this creation does not occur. See, this creation that is you, you are both a mind and a body. This is the product of a process that was rooted in necessity, right? There are some for whom it does not occur. What do we call them? We call them arahants. As an arahant passes away into parinibbana, whatever has happened to you does no longer happen to them. In other words, they are no longer a mind or a body. Minds and bodies no longer manifest once an arahant enters parinibbana. So if you ask me the question, where does an arahant go to once they attain parinibbana? What's the answer to that question? Then you'll have to answer the question, what happens to a flame once you blow it away? Where does a flame go? Does it go anywhere? It doesn't go anywhere, it goes nowhere. Where a flame came into being because of the causes that were present in that moment, once those causes cease to exist, the flame ceases to exist. That's the concept of cause and effect. When you bring in the concept of cause and effect, ladies and gentlemen, you can't talk about entities. Because entities come and go. Apparently. Why do I say apparently? Because entities never were. Right? So this is all a fiction. is like Tinkerbell. Where does she come from? She comes from Neverland. Where does she go to? She goes to Neverland. Well, it's all a fantasy. So in the same way, entities come and go, but that's just a fantasy. Do entities really come and go? Why not? Because there are no such things called entities. It's only an abstract concept. However, the problem is, because the ignorant mind is ignorant, the ignorant mind actually not only conceptualizes entities, but actually they realize entities. Not realize in the way that the Buddha realizes Dhamma, but realize. I think that's another meaning of the word realize, to make real. So to realize entities, the ignorant mind realizes entities. In other words, it thinks entities are for real. It's the thing, it's what's there, entities. So if something exists, it comes and it goes. When it comes, it comes. When it goes. And when it stays, it stays. That is why you feel you have come here today from home. You have arrived. And that's why you feel at the end of this sermon, you will go back home. See, you realize yourself. You think you're an entity. And the moment you think you're an entity, everything else around you also become entities. Just like these things I have in my hand. See, when I show this to you, you can't stop yourself from thinking that these are just blocks. Can you? I know that you know that these are blocks, building blocks, but you can't stop yourself there. Because you can see a border. And it's a very familiar structure. Is it not? Yeah, you see it every day. And because it's a very familiar structure, you can't help yourself from realizing this as an entity. Now, once again, please understand, when I say realize, I don't mean like the Buddha realized the Dhamma. To make real, unless there's a better word, please share with me. It's to make real. Realify? Like polarization? Madam? Okay. Materialize, I suppose, right? Okay. Materialize. As long as you understand what it means by that, is to think that it's for real. Okay? So, materialize, realize, whatever. But you understand what I mean by that? To think that this is for real, as in this whole structure as one unit, to think that there's more than the sum of the parts. That's what I mean. See, this structure is merely the sum of these parts. It's this part and that part and the other part and this part and this. You could count the number of parts that make this, and then you can add them up and say that this is the collection, the aggregation of X number of parts. Let's assume that there are, what, say, 10 parts here, just for argument's sake. This is the aggregation of 10 parts, 10 pieces, 10 blocks. But then you kind of think and feel that there is something more than just the 10 parts, the 10 blocks. And that's because each of these parts you put into a frame. So much so that if I took this part away, what have I just done? I've just amputated. This is an amputation of what? The poor man's foot. Huh? It doesn't have legs. You'll have to pretend that these are legs. Let's say this is the foot. So I've just amputated the foot. Don't you feel like something's missing in this structure? But technically, is there anything missing with this structure? Does this structure lack anything? from the perspective of the structure itself. I'm not talking about from the perspective of your interpretation of the world. Now, you know, you have to play along with me here, okay? This is not easy, I tell you, to get this idea across. If you ask me to stand on my head all day, that's easier to do than to get this point across. It's one of the most difficult things to get across because you are so used to thinking in the completely opposite way. Throughout samsara, that's what you have practiced. And then for me to stop this wheel that's turning so fast in the wrong direction, and then to turn it the other way, is almost impossible, ladies and gentlemen. Even the Buddha was able to do it with a very few individuals. The analogy he gives is, it's like a drop of water from the vast ocean, or a few grains of sand that you can hold on the tip of your thumb, compared to all the grains of sand that make up the whole world. It's only that proportion of people who will actually understand this. But I have trust, I have full trust in you. I have faith in you. Because you have merits, and merits is what you need to understand this. Without merits, there's no hope. You might as well give up. See, merits have to act in your favor in many ways right now. Number one, you have to be alert. If you had a heavy meal this morning, sorry. You picked the wrong day for that. Sunday mornings, don't take a heavy breakfast. Keep that for Saturday. Actually, don't do that either. If you come to the monastery, don't do that. Actually, just don't take heavy meals, full stop. Just have what is necessary for you to sate your hunger. Heavy meals are not good for you anyway. Right, anyway, I sidetrack. What was I talking about? Merits, yes? So it's your merits that's going to come to your rescue at this moment. You have to remain alert. So don't doze off. Not that you're doing it, but don't do it. Right? Keep yourself awake, keep yourself alert, and pay full attention to this. Don't bother anyone either side of you, and don't be bothered by anyone either side of you either. Pay full attention, because this is one of the most difficult things to get across. It's not because this is complicated, it's because this is very subtle. It's like threading a needle. It's not a difficult thing to do. It's not a complex thing to do. It's not like constructing a building. That's complex. Threading a needle is only difficult because it's very subtle. You need to pay full attention. With me? All right. What I hold in my hand is merely the sum of these parts. But you can't stop yourself from thinking and feeling and perceiving something more than that. You perceive that there's a man here with an amputated foot. And now, peace has been restored. Let me make your life difficult again. See, you can't help feeling that something's missing here. It's not your fault. It's just the way you are. There's something missing here. Now, if you showed this to an arahant, the arahant would also say that. This man has no foot. Right? And say a person like this wanted to become an anagarika, we wouldn't be able to do that. Actually, you don't need to lose a foot. You only need to lose one digit. And then we can't ordain you. Not my rules, I'm sorry. And there's a reason for that. I will not get into that now because we will sidetrack. Ask me another time. If I remember, I'll talk about it. But you can't help yourself from thinking that there's something missing here. In fact, when I put this piece back here, you feel that? It's all back to normal now. See, in your world, there's normal and there's abnormal. Isn't there? There's normal and there's abnormal. Reason for that, ladies and gentlemen, is because you see something more than just the sum of the parts. The whole, as they say, is bigger than the sum of the parts. That whole, not H-O-L-E whole, the whole thing. Because this entity, actually this is not an entity, but you can't stop yourself from entitifying this. But this is just an aggregation. That's why they call it the aggregates. It's the same thing that you do with yourself. You do the same thing with yourself. What you see in the mirror, you do this every day. That's why when you stand in front of the mirror and you open your mouth to smile, and let's say one of these is missing, what do you start cooking up inside you? We talked about this first thing in the morning. What is that? Embarrassment. Just ask yourself this question, okay? You don't have to nod, you can just blink with your eyes so that no one else knows. If you woke up in the morning and one of your teeth were missing, would you go out like that? Go to work, go to a party with your friends and just, you know, smile like you always do? You might force yourself, but it's not something you would like to do. And that's because in your mind, you create embarrassment. You create embarrassment when you undermine yourself. Please remember this. There's not a soul in the world that undermines you. And there's a reason for that as well. No one knows of your existence. I don't know where this is coming from, but this is euphoric to me. I'll keep on saying, please try and understand what I'm trying to get across to you here. Today is a good day. We started with the toilet, but it's getting much better. I'll say that again. Not the toilet part, the point I wanted to say. Not a soul in this world can undermine you because there's no one else in this world who knows of your existence. Now I know you're perplexed. You're like, what do you mean, Swami? So who are you talking to then? You'll ask me. Aren't you talking to us? Don't you know that we are here and that we exist? Isn't that why you're giving this sermon today? Why did you come all the way from Ingria to talk to no one? That's not what I mean. I'm not really talking to you. I'm talking to my mental formations of you. I don't know of your existence. I only know about my own thoughts. When you're dreaming, you see people, don't you? Do they exist? But do you know you're dreaming? See? So how do you know for certain that this is not a dream right now? How are you so dead certain that you're not in a dream right now? What if it's a dream within a dream? You don't know. So the point is, if in your dreams your mind cooks up people and those people seem very real to you, you talk with them, you eat with them, you hold hands with them, you walk with them, you sing with them, you dance with them, you do all sorts of things with them. The people in your dreams, don't you? Or do you say, hey, I know you're a dream. You tried, you thought you could fool me. Do you do that? No, you really interact with them, don't you? And your heart starts beating faster when you get scared. Some of you might have even proposed to someone in your dreams. Though there might have also been occasions where you propose to someone in the real world and then they said, only in your dreams. So, one way or the other, most have done that, even proposed in their dreams. But when you're in a dream, the people that you create, you know they're creations of your mind. There's no doubt about that, right? Your dreams are your mental creations. But then, those people don't exist for real. Is it not the same thing that's happening right now? Okay, do this for a second. For the people in the front row, look at me and do this. For the people in the subsequent rows, or the rows behind, look at the person sat in front of you. Just look at their head. Okay? Don't you feel that that person actually exists? That that person's actually there? He or she is in the room right now? How do you know? You're saying, well, I can see them, Swami Nuhansa. And if only you gave me permission, I could touch them and check. No, don't do that. No permission. All the while, you're just talking about what you create in your mind. See, you're talking about, I can see them. Seeing is not something that happens in the outside world. Seeing is a creation of the mind. Because you see color. Color does not exist in the outside world. By virtue of that very fact, you're going to have to accept that you can't trust what you see. By virtue of that very fact, ladies and gentlemen, you'll have to accept that you can't trust what you see, because you're seeing something that does not exist in the outside world. So how can you believe what you see? If we all saw without color, not monochromatic, I mean unchromatic or non-chromatic, right? If we all saw without color, I don't mean black and white, right? I don't mean black and white, because black and white are still colors, okay? If you could all see without color, but then the concept of seeing, you have no concept of seeing after that. Because what do you see? All you see is color. Color doesn't occur in the outside world. So then when you see, if you're referring to colors when you talk about seeing, then you have to accept that what you're experiencing is not something that's in the outside world. This is all in your mind. So there's a person sat in front of you. Are you sure? Here's all you can say. I see a person in front of me. I know there's a person in front of me. Could you say that? You can't say that. You can only say, I see there's a person in front of me. Whether what I see is actually there or not is anybody's guess. That's like saying, I saw a dream. So if you can see a dream, does that not prove to you the point that to see, they don't have to exist for real? What do you say when you see a dream? You wake up and you say what? You know, last night I saw a dream. I saw a dream. So then to see, they don't have to exist for real, right? That's why you can say, I saw a dream. What are you doing now? The person in front of you, you're seeing. So then do they have to exist for you to see them? No, because you see dreams which don't exist. So you're seeing now, they don't have to exist. Because seeing is something that happens in the mind. When you see, there's a formation that happens in your mind, driven out of necessity. So just like you are able to entitify if it gives me too much trouble, I'm going to amputate the guy. Just like you can entitify this structure, okay? You entitify who you think is there sat in front of you. You think there's a person sat in front of you. you fail to see that they're merely, you fail to see that they're merely aggregations, sum of parts, just like this one. You see the sum of parts, and then on top of that, you see the entity as well. I'm not suggesting here that you don't see the sum of parts. Okay? I'm not suggesting that you don't see the sum of parts. You do. You do see the sum of parts. You see the parts and you see the sum of the parts, and then you and then some. That's the problem. Once again, you see the parts, you see the sum of the parts. See, that's why you would say that this is, this, for example, is the chest or the upper body. Because you can consider the sum of the parts, and this becomes the upper body. These parts, they are part of the upper body. And the upper body is part of the whole body. These parts down below are parts of the lower body. And that lower body is part of the whole body. But that whole body is only a creation of your mind. If I take each of these parts away, as I'm doing right now, see, now that's the lower part of the body gone. Okay. That's the appendix. That's the diaphragm gone. Left arm. Right arm. Chest. Neck. Head. Why am I still holding my hand up here like this? Think, please think. Why am I still holding my hand up here like this? That's because in your mind, in addition to the sum of the parts, there was another thing. That's what I'm holding up. The whole, the entity, that's what I'm holding up in my hand right now. Can you see it? So shall we put the parts back where it belongs? Let's do that, shall we? Huh? To this entity to which all those parts belong? They belong to this, don't they? They belong to this, don't they? See? What is this part? See, you have an answer to that question. Ladies and gentlemen, that's insane. I'm just holding up a building block and I'm asking you what this is, and you're saying it is the head. Have you lost yours? I hope you're having as much fun as I am. Have you lost yours? What is this again? The head. Okay, that's why if I hold it down here, you feel something's wrong, don't you? Where does this go? Here? No. Here? No. Where does it go? See, you can even guide me. Tell me whether it's hot or cold. Hot or cold? Cold now, huh? And now? No? No? Hotter now? Now very hot. Now Sahara. What are you talking in reference to? Please think. What are you talking in reference to? Yes, exactly. The entity that you still have in your mind. Because you feel that this is the head of that entity. That's why if I put it down here, you'll tell me, no, Swami, no, so that's not where it belongs. It's supposed to be up here. This is the point I want to prove to you. Where is it then? Tell me. Where is that entity? I'm just holding up my hand like this. Shall I prove to you that there never was one here? Why am I holding my other hand up now? Because where was your entity? In my left hand. You never projected an entity to my right hand. Okay, how about now? Come on. What's going on with you? Isn't this a dream? This is what I mean. These are all entities that you create in your own mind. See how irrational you are. How illogical. How baseless these concepts that you create in your mind. And how so liberally you just project them onto the outside world, just like you're doing to the person sat in front of you right now. Just imagine if the person, now you're looking at their head. Just imagine if that turned 180 degrees and they were staring at you. What would be your reaction if that happened right now? I'd have to plug my ears, wouldn't I? You'd start screaming. Why? Because in your world, ladies and gentlemen, there's normal and there's abnormal. Normal is when all these parts fit to your entity. When it aligns with your entity, the entity that you create in your mind, that's when things are normal. That's how you set expectations. See, expectations don't occur unless you have entities. That's a really good point, actually. Thank you. As I said, I don't come with a script. I just let the Dhamma flow and see what happens. I learn a lot from these sermons, just as much as you do, maybe even more. Some of these ideas, I still don't know how to put them into words. I'm still learning myself how to express some of these ideas. But the ideas already occurred in my mind, so I have you to thank for that. So expectations can only occur after the entity. So the entity is always the precursor to the expectation. See, now you have an expectation. See? Yes or no? Where's the entity? Is the entity here? Where's the entity? Entity is with you. This piece, though, does not align with your entity. And so you say, no, Swaminathan, that's not where it's supposed to be. What are you then telling me? Swaminathan, I have an expectation. My expectation is that this piece is supposed to be here. And you give me a tick. And say, right, that's where it's supposed to be. So then we can piece all those things back together and make another one. I say another one. You know what you'll say? It's the same one. Why? Why is it the same one for you? Because although we dismantled the pieces, something still remained. What still remained? What persisted me taking each of these pieces out one by one? What persisted that? Your entity persisted. It remained. And because your entity remained, when I start putting these pieces back together, you'll say, now it's the same thing, but back together again. Like Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. And all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. But when I put this Humpty back together again, you're going to tell me, that's the same Humpty. If your grandfather came back from the grave, what would you call him? You'd still call him what? See, right? You'd still call him grandpa. You'd still call him grandfather. You'd still call him whatever you cha-cha, chi-chi, chu-chu, whatever pet names you had for him. Because you can't get over the fact that it's the same person. Where your grandfather's buried, let's say there's an apple tree that grows there, and the roots of the apple tree have gone deep into his grave, right? And now it's being, the nutrients that the apple tree takes to grow are the remnants of your grandfather's ashes. I doubt you will ever eat an apple from that tree. Why? Why? Why, yaar? Why? Because in your mind, that's still your grandfather. That's why. That's the entity I'm talking about. It does not exist in the real world, ladies and gentlemen. Doesn't exist in the real world. This is the fabrication of your mind. This is what jati does. The Buddha explains vijnana as a wizard, a magician, if you like, a magician that can perform tricks. Little do you know that you're always performing tricks, and you're doing it to yourself all the while, all the time. Once ignorance and attachment come into the picture, that whole process is only multiplied. And then not only do you see things as collections, but then you also draw this entity around it. So if I drew what you saw when I held that figure up in my hand, if I can draw it on the board, here's what you saw, okay? Here's what your eyes saw. Let me show you what your mind saw. That's what your mind saw. This outer layer, your mind, put that layer on top. It enwrapped this structure with that layer. And it doesn't stop there. Here's what else your mind saw. What is this called? The head. What is this called? The arm. The other one? Same. What is this called? Chest, shoulders. These are all again what? Entities. Then this is the upper body, whatever. These are the legs. This is the foot. And the same on the other side. So these are all entities as well. In addition to all that, put all those entities together and then you get another entity altogether. The point is this. Every object your mind perceives, it puts an entity wrapper around it. Every single object. Take the Himalayas. Now the Himalayas is a range of mountains. Let's just take Mount Everest. If I stood you in front of Mount Everest, and I asked you, what do you see? You will look at the foot of the mountain, and then you will see little rocks, gravel, grains of sand, all sorts, mud, clay, all sorts, right? As you go up, you'll start to see ice. You'll see all sorts. See, these are all individual things or collections. But this is only what your eyes see. Here's what your mind sees. And it doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop there. There's more. Until every time your mind perceives an object, it puts an entity wrap around it. Once again, look at the person sat in front of you for a second. You don't mind volunteering for this, do you? I'm asking from the people sat in front of the person behind. Don't worry. You don't even know that they're doing it, so it's fine, right? Okay. Look at their head for a second. Now, you're going to fail with this test because I'm going to ask you to look at their hair. Front row? Sorry. Look at their head for a second and look at each strand of hair on their head. Just look at individual strands of hair for a second. Just focus on a few strands of hair. Look at an individual strand of hair. When you see that individual strand of hair, don't you feel that that alone is an object, a separate individual entity of an object? That's your mind entitifying it. It's exactly what's happening here. Now, if you consider a few strands of hair, right, you might call it a patch of hair. Let's say someone shaved a part of their head but not the other part, or maybe like little islands. Right? Maybe that's their thing. Who knows, right? People, all sorts. Right? Let's say they just had patches of hair on their head. Now what you're doing is, again, you see individual strands of hair, and then you bring those individual strands together, and then you see patches of hair. That again becomes an entity. Well, then two entities together. Just imagine this, if you saw this. Imagine you saw this on someone's head. So this is their neck. So you're looking at the back of their head. And so initially we talked about individual strands of hair. Then we talked about, what do you call them? These little patches of hair. Now, sometimes when Swami knows, now when we shave, right, we don't always have a mirror to look at. We just feel our heads and we shave with the razor. On some occasions, we might miss a place or two, and that can happen. So what we tend to do is, after we shave, we just feel the entire of our head just to make sure the scalp, feel that there's nothing left. But sometimes it's possible that we miss, and then one of our monks will say, Swami Nansa, excuse me, you've missed a bit. Okay? Now, just imagine if something like that happened, and either because of illness or some kind of, you're losing your hair, or maybe this is just the way that they like to do their hair, right? And you see another patch. Yeah. And then you see another patch here. And then you see another patch here. Why did you start laughing at that point? Because you couldn't stop yourself from entitifying. That's what made you laugh. This is just hair. But you find that funny, don't you? Why? Here's what you see. Individual strands of hair. Don't you see that? Yes, those are all entities. And then you don't stop at the individual strands of hair, you see the patches. So the same here and same here. The same goes here, same goes here. But after all that is done, what else do you see? Because you have a pre-made structure of patterns, which are also entities. All these patterns that you have in your mind are all entities. Once again, I repeat this and I'll emphasize it. Even an arahant perceives patterns. So if you ask an arahant to stand in an orderly queue, he would. He's not going to come and ask, what do you mean a queue? If you ask an arahant to sit around in a circle so that we can all chant pirit, an arahant understands what a circle is. But in their minds, they don't entitify that. That's the point I want to try and get across. They don't see that as more anything more than the collection of the parts. They don't see a whole that is more than the collection of the parts. That's what they don't see. Not see, but rather perceive. Because what doesn't happen in their mind is rupan rupattaya, vedana vedanattaya, sanya sanyattaya, sankara sankarattaya, vinyana vinyanattaya, sankatam abhisankaranti. That doesn't happen in their minds. The process of mental fabrication does not happen in their mind. But when you look at that, you can't stop yourself from seeing a face. Not just seeing a face, but actually perceiving a face and taking that whole thing as one unit. So once again, I'll emphasize this point because I want you to have a clear understanding of... Actually, I'm not necessarily wanting you to understand what an arahant perceives, because there's no point in doing that. But to have some kind of idea as to where you perceive things that you shouldn't, it helps to just compare, right? If you asked an arahant, Venerable Sir, do you not see the pattern of a face? You don't even have to ask them. They can see the pattern. But the mental entitification of it does not happen. It's actually quite difficult for you to understand exactly what I mean by this unless you have gone through this experience. It's a bit like saying, water is wet. I cannot get that feeling across to you unless you have ever dipped yourself in water. That's when you know what I mean. It's like saying sugar is sweet to someone who has never tasted sugar. Because you'll keep on asking, what do you mean sweet? Is it like lemon? Is that what you mean sweet? No, that's sour. I mean sweet. What do you mean sweet? Like bitter gourd? No, I mean sweet. See, I can keep on saying that. No matter I say 100 times, you won't get it until you have experienced what sweetness is. But then there's no other way to get it across to you unless I explain through the Dhamma anyway. So this is kind of like a catch-22. You'll understand it once you understand it. And the way to understand it is to try and understand what you can't understand. There is no other way out of this. And that's okay. I mean, that's how we all understand. Those who have understood in the past, in the present day and in the future, the concept of anicca is to be understood by someone who does not understand anicca. It's after they come to that realization, then they realize, this is what you tried to mean all this while. Now I get it. In fact, all along you might even have other... You know, the thing is this, right? Say I'm trying to get across the feeling of sweetness, the sensation of sweetness to you. And I say, a toffee is sweet. Let's say you're just very unlucky. and you have a toffee, and that's a really bitter toffee. You put the toffee in your mouth and, okay, so that is sweet. I say, yeah, a toffee is sweet. And you're thinking something else, and I mean something else. So until you actually get it, you will keep thinking you've got something that is not what I meant. And that is also possible. You'll think you've got it, but it may not be what I mean. The thing is, I can't check whether you've understood exactly what I wanted you to understand. You've missed the boat on that one. For that, you should have come 2,500 years ago, because he would have checked you and made sure that you understand exactly what he meant. Now, it's a case of a bit of a hit and miss. That's why merit is the key here. That's why it's so crucial that you keep on doing merits, so that you can understand exactly what the Swaminathan say intends to get across. Okay? Now, come back to the point before we... almost 10:30. So where were we? Yes. Identification. So, I hold my hand up again. It's still there, isn't it? You know, even if I come back next week... Tonight when I get back, I'm going to shower. And I'm going to wash my hands with soap. And I'm going to shower. And then a whole week is going to go by, and I'm probably going to shed every skin, or every cell of dead skin cell that's on the surface of my hand. But still, I come back the next week and I hold my hand up here, and you say, Swaminathan, we can still see it. What does that tell you then? Is it in the outside world or is it in the inside world? It's in your mind. That structure which you fabricate in your mind is what you use to set expectations. In fact, it itself is an expectation. Things have to fit into that frame. There are times where you will adjust the frame, but that you will do it on your own will. At your own will. There are times where you're willing to adjust the frame, and then you will do. This is all formed by drushti. See, here I have another structure. Now, what was this again? What's this? Don't go block now. What is this again? Head. Okay. What have I just done? That's what they call a brain surgery. I just decapacitated. Yes. I just did that to this individual, took off its head. Actually, no, that was the head of the other guy, right? And I put that head back on here. Now you feel like we've done a head transplant. Okay, now bear with me. This is the original head from the other guy, as you know. So that's in my right hand. Here's the original head of this guy, right? In my left hand. Okay? This is which one? This guy. This one's the previous guy, right? Yeah? Okay, which one's which? Which one's which? You can't tell now. You'll say, that's because they're both white. If you'd picked a different color, we would have been able to tell, no problem. But you still feel that one of this is the right head, the other is the wrong head. but you're okay with me putting one of these back, but you will forever be in doubt whether I put the right head back on the right body. Today you might not even be able to sleep properly. Maybe you might have nightmares of someone's head being pulled off, right? So now you will forever have to be restless, not knowing whether we put the right head back on the right guy. That's why we mark things. That's why we name things. In fact, that's why we have sanya. Names for things. So that we can be confident that once we put order to chaos, we can always put those things back together. Because even if I pick these pieces up and throw it across the room, you will still feel that it's the parts of the thing, the structure, the man, that is strewn across the room. You will bring them back. And if I left the room now, one of you might even be kind enough to put Humpty back together again before you leave. Now, have you heard of this? I'm sure you all heard of it. OCDs, obsessive compulsive disorders. I'm being see strands of where such mental conditions might be cropping up from. Because it's a severe case. This is only my interpretation still. We're still researching some of these concepts, these ideas, so that we can help people. Because for some it's so severe that day-to-day life can become incredibly difficult. For me personally, I think it's a severe case of entitification. That things have to be in a particular order, in a particular way, with particular things have to be together, because that's a very strong case of an entity. Just like you are unsettled right now because you're not sure whether it's the right head or the right guy. Now just imagine if you had OCD, that would be a real problem to you. So much so that if there is anyone in the audience who has an OCD, okay, it will be really difficult for you not knowing whether we put the right head back on the right guy. Just imagine if we did this. And I left it like this. That would still not be right. If I left it here and I went out to the washroom or something, by the time I come back, someone will surely put it back here. Because that's how this entity is supposed to be. Because there's normal and there's abnormal. But there's nothing like that in the outside world. In the outside world, ladies and gentlemen, everything is normal. In fact, the whole concept of normal and abnormal are fallacies. What's right and what's wrong? Is it not merely an evaluation of your own, let's say, preconception? What's right, what's wrong? So today is, what day is it today? No, today is Monday. So if I kept referring to today as Monday, let's say I continue the sermon. So today being a Monday, ladies and gentlemen, we have to do things that we do on Mondays. So I continue today as being Monday. Did you buy Monday's newspaper? What was in it? So I keep asking these questions. You know, I could really drive you up the wall. There may be one or two individuals who get really annoyed with that. Say, Swami, no answer, today is not Monday, today is Sunday. That could could really annoy you. Why again? Why? What's right and what's wrong? So you tell me, no, Swami, today is Sunday. That's the right answer. Any other day is a wrong answer. I understand. Conventionally, yes, there's a right and a wrong answer. But remember what a convention is. What is a convention? A convention is your frame, isn't it? It's your frame of reference. That's what a convention is. And once you identify that convention, now you're asking for trouble. So when things don't fit into that frame of reference, inside, turbulence. This is why you suffer. Actually, I can do one better than that. This is the only reason you suffer. All of your mental vexations, all of your mental agonies, all of your pains, frustrations, annoyances, all of that is because of this. Your identification, and as a result of that, your expectations, and then you expect the outside world to conform to your models, to your structures, to your prefabrications. And when that doesn't tally, you feel the whole world is out to get you. That's why the Buddha comes into this world, and out of compassion for all of us, he teaches us this whole identification nonsense. It is the cause of your suffering. You're lighting your own fire. And the cause of that is attachment. The root cause of that is ignorance. Ignorance of what, once again? Ignorance of the fact that that is what you are doing to yourselves. Have I told you how much I love the Buddha's teaching? It's so beautiful. It's so delightful that once you understand it, you realize there's nothing more to do. Understanding it is all there is to do. He's made it so simple that we don't have to keep standing on one leg. We don't have to starve ourselves like they have to do in some faiths. We don't have to put ourselves to torture. We don't have to hang ourselves on hooks. We don't have to walk on fire. None of that. We don't have to submerge ourselves in water and hold our breath for minutes, hours at a time. We don't have to do any of that. We don't have to stay outside in the winter or in the cold, up in the Himalayas where it's almost unsurvivable. You don't have to do that. You don't have to sit outside in the rain to wash away your sins. None of that is necessary. You don't have to go on pilgrimages, ladies and gentlemen. You don't have to. Your pilgrimage is to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. That's your pilgrimage. Go on pilgrimage to the Noble Triple Gem. A pilgrimage to discover the Buddha. Go on a pilgrimage to discover the Dhamma, and go on a pilgrimage to discover the Sangha. Once you have discovered these three noble things, no further pilgrimages required. I speak with conviction. This is not just something I've read in a book or heard from someone that I'm relating to you. It is my personal experience. And that is why no matter what problem you bring to me, I can dismantle that problem and I can show it to you that once you understand the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, once you understand Anicca, Dukkha and Anatta, what's left of the problem? If all problems are mind-made, just like this one, and if you only make those entities because of your ignorance of Anicca, Dukkha and Anatta, Once you understand that, then you stop doing that. You stop fabricating those problems. Actually, you don't have to stop doing it because it doesn't happen anymore. There's no doer here. We've talked about this plenty of times. There is ignorance, but there is no one that is ignorant. Ignorance is what makes you feel that you are ignorant. So it would be unwise to ask the question, who is it that attains Nibbana? To attain Nibbana is to realize that there is no one to attain Nibbana. That is Nibbana. For as long as you think that it is I who has to attain Nibbana, Nibbana is still a long way off. See, this is that I. This is the I. The red line. That's the I that has to attain Nibbana. The same red line that you put around the five aggregates. Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana. The moment you put that red line around that five aggregates, now it's not just the five aggregates. They're what they call the five clinging aggregates or the pancha upadana skanda. That's why at the end of the Paticchasamuppada, the Buddha preaches sankittena pancha upadana kanda dukkha. Jatipi dukkha, jarapi dukkha, vyadipi dukkha, maranapi dukkho. Piyehi vipayogo dukkho, apiyehi sampayogo dukkho. Yankichan nalabati tampi dukkha. Sankittena, panchupadana kanda dukkha. Sankittena, pancha upadana kanda dukkha. That's the red line. So, does dukkha come from the outside or the inside? Who put the red line? You put the red line. The blue blocks, I brought them. Pancha skanda is not dukkha. Pancha upadana skanda is dukkha. That's your red line. Your red line occurs because you think such things exist. And because the mind thinks they exist, the mind wants to experience that. But they don't exist. So now the mind has to somehow fabricate what it wants. Just like a mother who loses her child in an accident. Right? If the mother's gone insane, now she thinks that the child is still alive, doesn't she? You might have seen people like that. The child's gone or the child was dead at delivery. But the mother is unwilling to accept that. It's not a mother, it's just a mind. The mind is unwilling to accept that. Now, although the child is dead, it was dead at birth. It was a miscarriage or a stillbirth. The mother, actually she's no longer, she's not a mother. She's a mother in her mind nevertheless. So she thinks that her child is still there. See how capable the mind is. If the mind wants something, careful. You're dealing with the most powerful weapon there is on planet Earth. If your mind wants something so badly, pay attention to these words and never forget them. If your mind will ever want something so badly, it will go as far as insanity if it has to. That's how dangerous attachment is. So don't rest on your laurels thinking that you are not a madman today. Don't take comfort in the fact that you are not crazy, you are not a lunatic today. It's just a matter of attachment, not a matter of time. It's just a matter of attachment. Because if attachment takes hold of your mind so fiercely and so severely, your mind will not stop at anything. It's even willing to go insane Because in insanity mode, it's able to fabricate what it wants. That's why a mother who has lost her child can go insane and then think that she still has a child with her. That's what's going on here. These are those red lines. Those red lines are products of your insanity. Why? Because such red lines don't exist, ladies and gentlemen. Such red lines don't exist. Panchaskandha is all that exists. The upadana is what you want. It's your desire. Your desire to see things as entities, to perceive things as entities. Because you have a desire for that, what does the mind do? It doesn't stop. If it has to become insane, then so be it. And someone who's insane is no longer in their control, are they? You have seen what some, you know, once you go insane, what people are capable of, because it's no longer their own willpower, it's no longer their own thinking. So, you know, there are two kinds of insanity. There's the kind of insanity for which people are taken to the mental hospital. So they think people on this side of the wall are sane. Really? Not if you ask the Buddha. Only an arahant is sane. A sotapanna is someone who has realized that they are insane. And then they work towards healing themselves and helping others to heal. That's what a sotapanna does. And then there are four stages of treatment. The first being sotapanna, which is the point you realize that you are insane all this while. Sakadagami is a point where you have treated yourself to some extent, anagami to the next extent, and once you are an arahant, that's when you are completely out of the woods. This is the fabrication of your mind. It's all in the mind. Did that make sense? Okay. Let's call it today then. Thank you for the volunteers who volunteered their heads for study and research purposes. We will talk about this in future talks as well. More examples, more metaphors, more similes. Because like I said, this is one of the most subtle things to get across. Because you've never looked at the world in this way, ladies and gentlemen. You've never looked at the world in this way. It's kind of like saying the world has no color. If I ever explained that without giving you a rationale behind it, would you accept it? Thanks to science, today we understand that actually the world has no color. You don't need Buddhism for that. Science itself has explained to us, right? If you study physics, you learn that there is no such thing called color in objects. They have pigments, but not color. But just imagine if all of a sudden someone said there's no color in the outside world. The trees are not green. The rainbow is not the seven colors. If someone just said that to you, would you accept that? Well, I mean, why would you? You should be punished for accepting something like that if there was no rationale behind it. Because that's your experience, right? See, what I'm having to do is go against your experience. Because your experience is always something that is veritable for you. You always verify things with your experience. If I tell you he's good, you're like, okay, but we'll see. If I tell you he's bad, all right, we'll see. Because you're waiting for an experience to happen. When something's your own experience, you take that wholly, completely, unquestioningly. So when I tell you that these flowers are not red, your experience tells you it's, if that's not red, what is red? You will ask me. But that's your experience, and now I'm having to go against your experience and try and convince something to you in a way that you've never seen the world before. So you know, in some ways, I am the one who should be offering you pirikara for bringing yourselves here every Sunday. Should be told. Because for you to come along every Sunday and listen to all this gibberish, when it doesn't make any sense at all, but for the simple reason that you believe that the Buddha was right. You have that faith in you. The Buddha must have been right. And there's one other thing. You know you suffer. You know you suffer and you've gone around the block. There are no answers to be found. So you're still looking for an answer. So you might as well try here as well. At least for that reason you bring yourselves here. You know, but the fact that when I'm saying these things that go completely and entirely against your experience of a lifetime, to still keep bringing yourselves here. Let's do it this way. Right? You put the pirikara here on the table, and then once you get down, you go back on a circle and you collect it again. Or have you something even better? Why don't you just exchange pirikara with each other? Just thank them for coming along to listen to all this when this makes no sense. It cannot make sense because it goes against your experience. But then once you realize that this is the truth, then you'll be willing to offer not just pirikara, but your whole life on this table. Once you realize that this is the truth. Because life itself is a quest for this truth. That's why. Shall I prove that to you? Once you have discovered this truth, you will no longer want to live. That is why I say, life itself is a quest for the Four Noble Truths. So that once you have discovered the Four Noble Truths, you will no longer have a need to live. That's why an arahant is not born again. Long live the Sambuddha Sasana. Right, let's do the merit transfer. And bring this wonderful sermon to a close. Wonderful not because of me, wonderful because of what we have been able to accomplish and achieve together. This is also an aggregation. There are no entities here. All these parts have come together to produce this result. So who can take credit? No one can take credit. Because what does sasana mean? No one. All right. Let us all take a moment then to transfer all the merits that we have all acquired today by listening to the Dhamma and inviting the Swami Maharaj to deliver the sermon, as well as creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the Dhamma. Let us take a moment, first and foremost, to transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, throughout the world who have, since time immemorial, protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us transfer these merits to the monks and nuns resident throughout the world, as well as in your local towns and villages, who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to the Mahanayaka Theras and the Anunayaka Theras of all of the chapters, resident throughout the world, who have made it their life's purpose to propagate the Buddha's teachings and help others to attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to my teacher, Guru Swami Mahanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and the Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to friends of the monastery, our devotees, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes, and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees and our teachers, as well as anyone and everyone who has helped make our lives that much better for us, who've left no stone unturned to help us, support and assist us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them. May they also be freed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who have passed away in our name, our loved ones, our forefathers, our ancestors, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life as we do and practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us also transfer these merits to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrifice their lives on our behalf, as well as people who have lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe. Let us also transfer these merits to those who have lost their lives from natural disasters and calamities, such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been friends of ours, mothers and fathers to us. They will have supported us and assisted us in many ways and forms. And out of a sense of gratitude towards all of them, and out of loving kindness and compassion, let us transfer all the merits we have acquired to all. May by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become a rahatan vahanse or an arahat thiranin vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you. Raga kinnan nidatnva Dvesha kinnan nidatnva Moha kinnan nidatnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravatma Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravatma Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravatma Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravatma Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravatma Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini niveva නිවන් සැප ලැබේවා. තුනුරුවන්ගේ සුවිසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බලෙන් සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්වයෝම නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුවිදතර වෙත්වා. සාදු සාදු සාදු.